and stronger than ever before.
Listen anywhere, anytime on the Odyssey app.
That's AUDACY. Music, news, sports, podcasts, and now 90.3 WHPC.
The voice of Nassau Community College.
This is the award-winning 90.3 WHPC HD Garden City.
Listen on your smart speaker.
Play WHPC.
And available on Odyssey and iHeartRadio.
All right, 5 p.m. on Friday. The weekend is here. It's official. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. Let's celebrate good times. Not just the fact that it's 5 p.m. on a Friday, but the fact that we are back live on the radio in the station. This is like wonderful. Great. A bit crazy, but also wonderful. Of course, what we do on Fridays is How Music Changed. It's the series where we discuss 250 specific topics, hoping to cover the expanse of recorded music and how it developed over the years from its very inception. And for the past about a half a year almost now, we've been covering the music of Duke Ellington. We are getting near the end of this series. We pick up today with Duke Ellington and the music that he was releasing in the 60s. And it was a really strange and interesting time for Duke because, I mean, obviously at this point in time, a lot of people did not understand his relevance any longer or missed his significance. Because
they missed his heyday.
Well, they were born too late. You know, I mean, rock and roll happened.
Born too
and,
late.
Right, the ponytails. If you weren't alive to hear what Ellington was accomplishing in the 30s and the 40s, and even in the 50s, you'd probably begin to find that you dismiss it as something that's too old to matter, and that Duke being a part of that generation wasn't necessarily as relevant as pop music. But the beautiful thing is that Ellington was one of the most restless, creative people that that I've ever had the privilege of like doing his history. I mean, I'm shocked by how much this man did, how much he accomplished, how he never stopped working and never stopped trying to do something new. So we're going to pick up with a track from the Reprise years. I think that's where we left off last week when he was bouncing around a lot with labels, Columbia, Capitol, and here now he's on Reprise, and it didn't quite live up to the advanced billing for the most part, but the first 3 months of Ellington's contract did produce some incredibly great work. And I almost overlooked this because it was hard to find these albums. But the first album was called Afro Bossa, as in, you know, Bossa Nova, sort of, right. This was about Ellington and Strayhorn trying to explore internationally inspired sounds. Lots of percussion, muted horn arrangements. Really, maybe, according to Harvey G. Cohen, who wrote Duke Ellington's America, says that it actually is one of his best albums of all time. Modern and yet sometimes faintly reminiscent of the jungle jazz of the Cotton Club days. So let's play two tracks from that album. We'll play the title track, Afro Bossa, and we'll segue that into Blues in C on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. Afro Bossa is the name of that track. By the way, I realized I had to come back before playing Blues in C because that song is from the next album I wish to speak about. This is what is so amazing to me about Duke Ellington. Here is a man that is in his early 60s, and he's probably doing more work than he's ever done in his entire life. He's on Reprise Records, and in 3 months, he releases three albums. He releases an album a month, and each one is totally unique. Afro Bossa, we heard what that's basically about and how that, the creativity of that track that we just heard. Totally unique, unlike really anything else that was happening at the time. He followed that up with an album called The Symphonic Ellington, which was basically him teaming up with symphony orchestras to do symphonic versions of some of his other compositions, like Harlem. He wrote a 17-minute piece called Night Creature. And then another album, which was from February of 1963, that he recorded in Paris, where he brought in his own violinist, Ray Nance, from the Ellington Orchestra, Sven Asmussen, and Stefan Grappelli. So it's essentially Duke Ellington and three violinists making up music.
Nice.
And it's just called Ellington's Jazz Violin Session. And it's awesome. Two tracks from that album then, Blues in C and Limbo Jazz on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
it's very unusual. And like I said, this Ellington in this period, you just would not have any idea what to expect. It was
surprise.
It was incredible. Now, as I said, he released three albums in 3 months on Reprise, and eventually Reprise basically did away with their entire jazz artist catalog because they were taken over by Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers was a pop label, and so they more or less consolidated that and started putting pop artists onto the Reprise label. And that was where Ellington found himself basically looking for a place, a new home again. But Think about this. In 1 year, September 1962 to September 1963, listen to what Ellington did. He produced albums with Charles Mingus and Max Roach. We played that last week.
Yep.
John Coltrane played that last week. Did an album with Coleman Hawkins. Did that last week. Released Afro Bossa, the Symphonic Ellington, Ellington's Jazz Violin Session, which we just heard, and My People, one of his...
No moss on him.
This is from a guy who's almost 65 years old. Stunning. Meanwhile, at around this time also, he did make an appearance up in the Berkshires, where Heidi and I have got our summer house at Tanglewood. And that became an album, which had featured Ellington performing some... a little bit of his new material and also some classics, because at a situation like that, you're going to want to have to, you got to try to make everybody happy. So let's play one of the classics with its updated arrangement of the Duke Ellington Orchestra live at Tanglewood, the version of the song Caravan on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHBC. Man, live performances from Tanglewood. I think the year was 1963. Just amazing. They played with perfection. The performances. Tanglewood is quite the institution. Still is.
It's like playing Carnegie Hall. You got to just bring your A game.
Absolutely. It is. It is. Well, now we get to something which is like another, again, Ellington. I'm going to read, to make it easier, from Harvey Cohen's book, Duke Ellington's America, here, to introduce the next track. In the mid-60s, as Ellington's Sacred Concerts premiered, some in the press speculated that Ellington's religious faith represented an 11th-hour conversion, an attempt to atone for a life of supposed indiscretions. Ellington biographer James Lincoln Collier argued that the Sacred Concerts were Ellington's bid to be viewed in the same light as the great pre-20th century classical composers, many of whom wrote religious oratorios and masses. Misperceptions like these emerged because, as with some of his deeper and angrier feelings about black history and civil rights, Ellington generally kept his religious thinking private and separate from his role as an entertainer. Before 1965, he did not view them as topics for public discussion. But as the Sacred Concerts garnered international acclaim and controversy, and religious institutions of many denominations clamored to present them, it inspired him to open up on the subject increasingly in his last years. Ellington's relationship with God was unconventional in that he adhered to no denomination and did not live a quote-unquote moral life according to usual religious dictates. But many sources indicate a sincere, long-time faith revealed to family and friends over the decades. After at least 2 years of planning, Duke Ellington and his orchestra performed a sacred concert in San Francisco's stately Grace Cathedral on September 16, 1965. By late 1973, he had created three separate sacred concerts, and we'll get to the others in future shows, segments, of course, performed over 100 times to sold-out audiences in churches and secular venues around the world. He called them his most important work, though, as Jana Tull Steed pointed out in her short history of the spiritual side of Ellington's life, he did not refer to them as his best work. They probably were not his best work, though strident denunciations of them by latter-day observers miss their beauty and sincerity, as well as their historical, musical, and personal context. There were significant events heavily covered and discussed in the mainstream and religious media. Once again, Ellington was using his music to bring issues of personal and historical importance to center stage in American society, transforming American culture. Here is, from the very first of his sacred concerts, Duke Ellington Orchestra performing the Lord's Prayer on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Lord above, begging you, Jesus, give me more grace. I need your power to help me to run this race. Yeah. Hallowed be thy holy name. Kingdom come, as it will be done. Done on earth, as it is in heaven. Then lead, oh lead, oh lead. Temptation, deliver our soul from sin and evil. Thine is the kingdom, power and the glory. We are bound forever. Just say, just say,
Right? Gospel. Always swinging gospel.
Always did like the gospel tent.
The idea of a jazz orchestra in churches, although Ellington never allowed that word in ads or programs, elicited serious resistance in many quarters at first, especially in the black community. But Ellington's presentations, highly differentiated from the band's usual approach, eventually won over critics, and the Sacred Concerts became the most profitable and publicized ventures of the last decade of his career. They represented another important step in his effort to divorce jazz and African-American music from an unsavory or limited reputation, instead depicting black music as a rich and exalted tradition capable of expressing and encompassing any human emotion. Now, he's making all of these records, but he's still struggling. Again, reading from the book. Previous chroniclers of Duke Ellington's life, as well as Ellington himself, refer to himself as a poor businessman. What the Ellington business records in various interviews reveal is that he was actually successful in achieving his goals, which mirrored the priorities of other black entrepreneurs of the period. While he made a lot of money over the course of his career, he did not accumulate wealth in the classic Andrew Carnegie fashion, extracting profit from each division in the most efficient manner and amassing a fortune. Though, with the high amount of royalties pouring into Tempo Music and Duke Ellington, Inc., he certainly could have. Instead, he sought to support friends, family, and community, the full-time touring of his orchestra, and perhaps most importantly, his composing and his ability to hear his work immediately, on his own terms, helping those he loved, and keeping his five-decade streak of creativity going strong, Ellington proved extraordinarily successful in wielding his economic power. One more track from this era. This song is called House of Lords on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Thank you.
Another track from the first Sacred Concert. Amazing that basically, you know, bringing jazz into church. But yeah, like I said, didn't want to use that word. It was religious music without it being denominational is what he was going for. And again, speaking of finances, old friends and band members depended on Ellington, receiving substantial help from him over the years, particularly in the 50s and 60s. Though no records in the Smithsonian's Ellington collections confirm this, numerous sources confirmed that drummer Sonny Greer was paid regularly by the Ellington organization for years, probably decades, after he left the band in the early 50s. Of course, Sonny felt like he never got enough. They told a story that Greer's notorious sense of humor. He says, I remember Sonny coming up to Ellington's dressing room. I think it may have been in the Rainbow Grill in the 70s. He come in and he says, you, expletive, you stole my band. He was talking about the Washingtonians back in the mid-1920s. But Duke kept him on the payroll, even though he hadn't been working for him for two decades. Meanwhile, Brad McHugh, an RCA Victor producer and A&R executive, recalled getting a call from jazz producer and entrepreneur Norman Granz, who was acting as Ellington's personal manager for a short period during this time. This is probably around the time when he was recording with Ella Fitzgerald. He said, how'd you like to be responsible for Duke Ellington coming back to RCA Victor after a two-decade absence? Granz asked them. Duke isn't money-hungry. Heck, he'll take $12,000 an album. How many albums do you want? At 12. That figure was higher than McHugh and usually allotted an artist. But for Ellington, this is his quote, my feeling was, and it's even more so now, he's going to sell forever. So if we don't make it the first year, we're sure going to make it eventually. And that's been borne out. The contract specified four albums over 3 years and an unlimited extension upon approval of both parties. But Ellington soon found that despite McEwen's being an avid Ellington fan, he had to execute a distasteful trade-off to record the music he most wished to release. McEwen described the deal. It was obvious, talking for 5 minutes with Duke, that the Concert of Sacred Music LP was of paramount importance. Acting like a typical company man at this point, I said, I can't envision this as being one of your best-selling albums. It certainly is one any Ellington collector would want, but a mass sale, you know, I was a little skeptical. Victor had an experience with Paul Horn doing a religious album. I do know it didn't sell. A deal that Duke and I made, kind of verbally, was he wanted to do things, and obviously I needed to have a couple of albums that would sell really big. So I said the best example would be the popular Duke Ellington, which he didn't fight it, but his face fell every time the subject came up. We played a track from that, by the way, last week when we ended our show with the popular Duke Ellington version of Take the A-Train. So Ellington put together a similar deal as a quid pro quo for agreeing to record and release The Far East Suite, which was Ellington's best album of the last decade of his life and a consistent seller on RCA ever since. Upon hearing those songs for the first time, McEwen told Ellington that they didn't sound like a Billboard chart album. And Ellington's albums presented a telling problem for the sales staff. They were used to selling albums that sold well for a few weeks while the marketing campaign ran strong and then died thereafter, circumstances especially prevalent with rock and roll. Ellington's LPs, however, were typical of his old things. They just kept on going, and the younger distributor people, expecting the same pattern as in the old pop albums, constantly had to reorder. The staff was not used to such drawn-out sales patterns, and in the mid-60s, Concert for Sacred Music and the Far East Suite both made RCA sales departments very happy, won Grammy Awards, and even sold more in decades to come. However, the popular Duke Ellington sold 2 to 3 times more than either of them in the short run. Releasing artistically challenging material proved to be as much of a struggle for Ellington in the 60s as it was in the 30s, despite his track record of proving solid catalog sales over the decades. Now, we're talking about the Far East Suite. There's a story there. In the fall of 1963, after years of urging from the press, the United States government sent Duke Ellington and his orchestra on a 3-month State Department goodwill tour. The Far East Suite from 1966, the band's best album of the 60s, according to Mr. Cohen, arose from the continental and colorful sights and sounds that Ellington and co-composer Billy Strayhorn absorbed during the trip. The government could not have picked a more appropriate ambassador and spokesman than Ellington during this period of heightened civil rights Cold War.
As seen in publicity for the 1963 state tour and in international press clippings distributed by the government in the years preceding and following the tour, Ellington was portrayed abroad as a symbol of the best in American culture. The United States government depicted jazz as high culture. Times were changing. From the Far East Suite, this track is called Blue Pepper on AmericanNet Radio, 90.3 WHBC. Almost a rock and roll beat there from Duke. I mean, this show is
lively.
Can you believe how many different styles we've encompassed in just 1 hour, covering about a 3-year period of what Ellington was doing?
He was a music lover.
It's incredible. And meanwhile, like I said, basically, for the most, not struggling to survive. He was doing okay, but he had money issues. Ellington's business papers make it clear that staying on the road with his big band was, in many respects,
it was not cost-effective.
Very stressful, economically disastrous, really. His problems with the IRS exacerbated the situation, leaving him hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and penalties to be paid by his estate after his death. The return of Courtney, who was helping him with his accounts, to the fold in 1968 improved the financial picture, but could not erase previous debts and abuses or stop Ellington's generous financial outpourings to family and friends. Ellington probably knew that no windfall of money from record sales or other sources would bail him out of his situation. And if he was even concerned about his financial situation, he could have sat home and let the money roll in with little effort. So why did he put himself through it? The answer is simple. Here's his quote. "With me, it's some kind of basic, primitive, impetuous need. If I write a piece of music today, I've got to hear it played tonight. That is the problem with me," He said that in 1966. And meanwhile, any of his band members would tell you when they would need, you know, basically they were on salary, but they always needed more. And they were always borrowing money from Duke. And he was always saying, okay, meet me in the office. I'll cut you a check. And when they left the band, they'd walk away owing him thousands of dollars.
Mm.
Just an amazing situation that he somehow managed to hold together. Well, I want to remind you that you're listening to American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. We do this every Wednesday and Friday between 5 and 6. We have now got 24 shows under our belt dedicated to Duke Ellington, maybe about two more to go to wrap this one up. And then we move up to the present, well, to the more modern side of what we do. That'll be in a couple of weeks. We'll surprise you. And if you want to catch some of our shows, just find the diversity of what it is that we're doing, go to our website, AmericanHitNetwork.com. Easy to find. Or just search for American Hit Radio. It pops right up. Every Friday show from How Music Changed is posted there. Every Wednesday show is posted there. Right now, I think that what that means is that we've got approximately 500, maybe 600 shows posted on the website, if you can believe it or not.
Many, many.
So there's an awful lot for you to see there and to dig through. And a lot of hopefully not just entertaining, but also informative things that are happening there. All right, let's close this out. One more track from Duke Ellington during the RCA, his RCA Victor era. This song is called After All, and we'll leave you with this. On American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC, here's Duke Ellington and his orchestra.
Thank you.